unless we wake at the end at least briefly. Like all dreams, nightmares occur in REM sleep. Although newborn babies presumably have rudimentary dreams, since they spend a great deal of time in REM sleep, during which they show eye movements and little smiles, we do not know whether they experience what we generally consider to be true dreaming, with complex images, sounds, feelings, and thoughts. But dreams, including nightmares, unquestionably do occur during the second year of life, a fact that becomes progressively clearer as a child develops speech and hence the ability to describe his dreams. The content of a one-year-old's nightmare is likely to be simple. Typically, he will recreate and re-experience a recent frightening event. Even though a one-year-old cannot describe his dream well, he may have enough verbal ability to indicate that it concerned a recent blood test, car accident, or bee sting. A child of this age does not understand the difference between a dream and reality, so on waking, he will not understand that the dream is over. He may still be afraid, as if the threat from the dream were still present. If he dreamed of a bee, for instance, his continued behavior, pointing, and words, "buzz, buzz here," may further demonstrate his conviction that the bee is still in the room. By the time a child is 2, his dreams have become more symbolic, with monsters or wild animals typically representing his impulses and fears. By this time, he has begun to understand the concept of a dream, but he cannot yet fully appreciate the difference between dreaming and reality. He may describe dreaming of a monster, yet still insist that the monster hasn't gone yet. As the child grows, his dreams become more complex. At the same time, he becomes more and more capable of distinguishing dreams from the real world. By about age 5, he is likely to wake from a dream with an immediate and full understanding that he has been dreaming. It will be harder for him to reach this point after waking from a nightmare. A child's ability to accept a dream as just a dream continues to develop, so that by the age 7, he may be able to handle an occasional nightmare without waking anyone for support. Still, even in an older child, the feeling of fright on waking from a nightmare is very real. As one child said, "Mom, I know what happened in the dream wasn't real, but the dream was real." The rational knowledge that nightmares come out of one's own imagination may have limited power compared to the emotional impact of the experience. Thus, Hannah, an 11-year-old girl, got up during the night to check that her younger brother was all right after dreaming that he had died, even though she knew full well that it was only a dream. Although nightmares occur during sleep, for the most part, they are caused by and reflect emotional conflicts that arise from a child's waking life. These conflicts are just the usual struggles children face throughout their normal development. Partly for this reason, all children have nightmares at one time or another. Some nightmares have other causes, such as illness or medication, and some seem to happen for no particular reason at all, at least none that can be easily identified. The specific content or story of your child's nightmares depends on several factors: his stage of physical and emotional development, the particular emotional conflicts he faces at his current developmental stage, and any particularly scary or threatening daytime events he's been exposed to recently. The anxieties that produce nightmares may also lead to fears at bedtime and during periods of wakefulness at night, possibly interfering with your child's ability to fall asleep or get back to sleep. These problems are discussed in Chapter 7. Young toddlers commonly fear separation from their parents. Your child may have nightmares when he first goes to daycare, when you go out of town or must be hospitalized, or after he has briefly gotten lost in a store. As he gets a little older, he becomes more concerned about losing your love than about temporary physical separation. For example, he may fear that he is losing you to a new brother or sister. Or in his third year, during toilet training, he may struggle with his own impulse to soil, while at the same time wanting to please you and fearing your disapproval. His dreams at these times may well reflect these anxieties. Children between the ages of 3 and 6 must resolve many aggressive and sexual impulses. Your child will discover that he enjoys touching his genitals, and he may be jealous of your attention to a new baby and want to hit him or her. But he may also be frightened by his desire to do such things, especially if he believes you won't help him control his aggressive urges or thinks he will be punished for giving in to the sexual ones. If he isn't taught that such urges are normal, shown what kinds of behavior are acceptable, and help to control temptations toward truly inappropriate or harmful behavior, then the scary feelings associated with these impulses may take shape as monsters that frighten him at bedtime and during dreams. A 3 to 6-year-old may also be disturbed if he witnesses violent behavior or overhears loud arguments at home. He may sense that you cannot control your own behavior and worry that you won't be able to help him stay in control himself. A child may also feel conflicts deriving from the desire to replace one parent as the other parent's partner. Such anxieties can be stimulated further if the child is allowed to act out these feelings. Daniel, a 5-year-old boy I saw, came into his parents' bed every night and ordered his father to leave. If his father did not go immediately, Daniel would begin to hit him. At that point, his father would always move to another room. It was easier to give in than to struggle, and he could at least get some sleep that way. But for Daniel, having this power over his father was frightening. He was not sleeping well at all during this time, and he had frequent nightmares in which he was threatened by monsters. Children around this age are often also struggling to understand the concept of death, and they may be afraid of falling asleep and never waking again. Alexander, age 6, never had any difficulty sleeping until he went to his uncle's wake. He was told not to worry because his uncle would look just like he was sleeping. In fact, he learned his uncle had died in his sleep. Alexander's nightmares after this experience were related to his concerns about death and his confusion between sleep and death. Anything that a child finds frightening or cause for worry can trigger bad dreams. Lauren, a 5-year-old girl, came to see me with her family after 3 weeks of nighttime wakings that began after she saw a scary movie, one she probably should not have been allowed to see. Since then, she had been waking and screaming for her parents at about 3 in the morning several times a week. They would find her awake, alert, and shaking, clearly very frightened. Her dreams were not identical from night to night, but their content resembled that of the movie she had seen. Her parents would stay with her only briefly and refuse to allow her into their bed because they did not want her to develop what they considered to be bad habits. But being unable to get help at night only scared Lauren more, and her nights got even worse. Soon she did not want to go to bed at all, and she fought with her parents to keep them from leaving her alone at night. In children between 7 and 11 years old, nightmares ordinarily occur only occasionally, generally less than once a month. The conflicts of the preceding years should have been largely resolved by then, or at least repressed until adolescence, and new stresses are likely to be taken more in stride. If you have a child who at this age still has frequent nightmares, perhaps several each month, he may be struggling with conflicts that were not successfully resolved at an earlier age, or he may be facing significant new or ongoing stresses. During puberty and throughout adolescence, new conflicts and anxieties emerge. As your child becomes an adult physically, sexually, emotionally, and cognitively, he has to face new stresses every day. Nightmares seem to become somewhat more common at this time, although it is often difficult to say for certain, because adolescents are less likely than younger children to talk to family members during the day about their dreams, and they are certainly less likely to wake their parents at night after having a bad dream. How to help your child if he is having nightmares. If your child has nightmares only now and then, maybe one every few months, a straightforward approach is usually sufficient. If your child is less than 2 years old, remember that he does not yet understand that dreams are not reality. You won't have much success by trying to show him that it was just a dream. He simply needs to be held and comforted, just as he would after a frightening event in the daytime. For a 2-year-old, soothing, reassuring words will also help. At this age, he may also be comforted if you listen sympathetically while he describes his dream or fears to you. If your child is 3 or 4, it may be useful to remind him that he was dreaming, though you must still treat his fear with empathy and reassurance. Even if he did not find it important to sleep with a nightlight on or his door open when he was younger, he may now. When he wakes from a dream, the nightlight lets him see around his room and remember that he is at home, and not in the dream scene. With the door open, he will feel less shut off from the rest of the house and closer to other family members. It will be easier for him to orient himself and accept that the dream is over and he is safe. After waking from a particularly frightening dream, he may even want an even brighter light turned on. The main point to remember when your child wakes from a nightmare is that he is truly frightened and needs your full reassurance and support. If he is afraid to go back to sleep, you may have to stay with him for a considerable time. The length of time it will take for him to calm down may vary. Younger children typically need more time than older children, and of course the more intensely frightened they are, the longer it will take. Occasionally lying down with him, or even taking him into your bed, won't hurt, and in fact, it's the most reasonable approach when your child is very upset. Be supportive in a calm and convincing way, showing that you are in control and able to keep him safe. This is not the time to be extremely firm. It is unwise to shut your child's door when he is already too afraid to be alone. On the other hand, you should not feel obliged to grant all your child's requests in an effort to allay his fears. For instance, as discussed in Chapter 7, don't feel compelled to turn on lights all over the house, look under the bed, rifle through the closet, rearrange the furniture, and lock the windows. Remember, rather than reassuring him, such actions ultimately only support beliefs that monsters may be real and somewhere in the house. Instead, respond to his true needs by letting him know calmly and clearly that you will take care of him and protect him. Often, even a 13-year-old who feels too grown up to be hugged in the daytime will appreciate such reassurance when he wakes frightened after a nightmare, and while an older adolescent may not need the physical comfort, he may on occasion still want someone close by to talk to. If your child is having frequent nightmares, several a month, say, you need to work with him during the day to solve the problem. Try to determine what is worrying him and see if you can help relieve his anxiety. For example, if your 1-year-old has difficulty leaving your side, activities that practice separation, such as peekaboo, which makes a game of your disappearance and reappearance, might help your child feel comfortable when he is apart from you. If your 2-year-old is having nightmares during toilet training, even when it has been going well, try relaxing the training efforts for a while and encourage messy play, such as finger painting. For 3 to 6-year-olds, children's books about sleep and dreams may help. You can also begin to talk directly to your child at this age about his fears and concerns. Screen the books, movies, and television shows that your child sees. It goes without saying that you will want to avoid very scary ones, but because so much sex and violence regularly appear on primetime television and in commercials, you will also need to monitor the rest of his viewing. Even if your 4 or 5-year-old enjoys these shows and does not seem frightened by them, they could still stimulate enough anxiety to cause nightmares. By all means, allow your child to express his feelings, whatever his age, but teach him appropriate limits. Avoid moral condemnation. Don't make him feel guilty about having angry or sexual feelings. Instead, help him learn acceptable ways to express them, such as by talking angrily but not hitting. He may be reassured to learn that you used to have fights with your sister or brother, or that everyone finds that it feels good to touch his or her genitals. With an older child, foster open communication and frankness, and encourage him to discuss his concerns, even if they have to do with difficult issues, such as divorce, sex, or drugs. Daniel was the 5-year-old who kicked his father out of bed every night and struggled with frequent nightmares. When I discussed the situation with his parents, they agreed that they should be the ones making the decisions about who slept where, not Daniel. But they also came to understand that by giving in to his nightly demands, they had unwittingly been depriving him of a sense of security. They began by insisting that Daniel stay in his own bed at night, and despite his initial protests and struggles, Daniel was ultimately much more comfortable with this demonstration that his parents were in control. Before long, his nightmares disappeared altogether. Alexander, whose nightmares began after he attended his uncle's wake, clearly needed to work through the fears that he had developed in its aftermath. With coaching, his parents began encouraging him to discuss his feelings openly about his uncle's death and funeral, and after they corrected some of his misconceptions and read him a children's book about death, his bad dreams went away. Lauren's fears and frequent nightmares had started after she saw a scary movie, and they didn't seem to reflect any deeper anxieties. Because she was so frightened when alone at night, I suggested that one of Lauren's parents temporarily sleep in her room all night until her fears and nightmares stopped. In the meantime, during the day, they would discuss the movie with her to help her deal with the fear. Lauren was relieved by this show of support. Within 2 weeks, she was going to bed happily, and the nighttime wakings and scary dreams had stopped. She then agreed to try sleeping alone again, but with the promise that if she had another bad dream, one of her parents would return and stay the rest of the night. She had one more nightmare the next week, and her mother came willingly. After that, the problem was gone. Occasionally, nightmares are a symptom of severe emotional difficulties. Regardless of your child's age, if he has frequent nightmares, perhaps weekly or more, over a period of more than 1 or 2 months, and you can't identify the cause of the stress he is feeling and help him resolve it, then you should consider seeking professional help. This is especially true if your child also is troubled by fears during the daytime that seem excessive for his age, such as marked difficulties being away from you, unreasonable fears of being in his bedroom alone, reluctance to go to school, or major phobias. As a parent, you should expect to take some part in at least some of the counseling sessions. If your child's anxiety reflects things he has seen or heard, and perhaps does not understand, you may merely need help learning to recognize and deal with the causes of his distress. But if the issues are more deep-seated, they will be less responsive to emotional support alone. In that case, longer-term therapy will likely be needed. Nightmares and confusional events. Before you try to address your child's nightmares, you should first be sure that nightmares are in fact, the problem. If he cries out in the middle of the night and seems frightened, or jumps out of bed appearing very upset, then you might assume he had a bad dream. But you should also be aware that he might have had a confusional event, specifically a sleep terror, confusional arousal, or episode of agitated sleepwalking, as discussed in Chapter 13. It is important to determine which kind of event it is, because the appropriate responses are quite different. The two phenomena are easy to mistake for one another, and to further confuse matters, the terms nightmare and sleep terror have sometimes incorrectly been used interchangeably. Nightmares are frightening dreams that occur in REM sleep and are followed by full waking. Sleep terrors, on the other hand, like other confusional events, occur during a partial arousal from the deepest phase of non-dreaming sleep. Although in principle it sounds easy to distinguish the two, in practice the distinction is not always so obvious, especially in a young child. The differences between nightmares and sleep terrors and other intense confusional events are discussed here. Chapter 13 deals with confusional events in detail. Nightmares usually occur toward the end of the night, when REM sleep is most intense. In contrast, confusional events happen during the first few hours after a child has fallen asleep, when non-REM sleep is deepest. After a nightmare, a child who is old enough can describe a dream, but after a confusional event, there is no dream to report. When your child wakes from a nightmare, he will cry if he is young, or he may call for you if he is older. He recognizes you immediately and wants you to hold him and comfort him. He remembers the dream then, and he will still remember it in the morning. A child in the midst of a confusional event, on the other hand, is not fully awake. He may cry out regardless of his age, but the cry may sound more like a scream, or he may talk, moan, and cry all at the same time in a confused and possibly unintelligible way. During the episode, he will not recognize you or allow you to comfort him. If you try to hold him, he may push you away and become more agitated. If he does wake briefly at the end of the confusional event, he will not remember the preceding yelling and thrashing, and he will have no memory of a dream. In the morning, he may vaguely remember being awake and perhaps talking to you during the night. That is the period after the confusional event, but no more. A child who has been frightened by a nightmare will remain frightened even when fully awake. Often he will be reluctant to go back to sleep alone in his bed afterward. He may even be afraid to go to bed for several nights following an especially scary dream. On fully waking after a confusional event, however, the child will relax. All signs of fear and agitation disappear, and he will return to sleep rapidly. Since he is unaware of the episodes, he will not be reluctant to go to bed on following nights. It is much more common for parents to misinterpret confusional events as nightmares than the other way around. If a child is too young to describe his dreams, his parents may simply assume he has had a bad dream whenever he wakes crying and upset. They may not make the same assumption when an older child wakes, thrashing or screaming, even if he does not describe a dream after he quiets down. If a child calls out, "Help me!" his parents may understandably jump to the conclusion that he is fully awake and reacting to a nightmare that he just had. Parents struggling to wake their child from a sleep terror may be misled by his initial confusion and lack of receptiveness. If he pushes them away, they may conclude that he is still dreaming, fighting off monsters. If they succeed in waking him as the event ends, their own anxious questions may make him fearful, as he would be after an actual nightmare. Telling him about his bizarre behavior may do the same, since until it's described to him, he'll be unaware that anything unusual had even happened. Now, instead of returning to sleep rapidly as he otherwise would, he may be unable to or unwilling to try. Even if he isn't frightened, once he is fully awake he may enjoy the attention, and if his parents keep asking him what he was dreaming about, he may make up a story to satisfy them. Remember, as we saw in the previous chapter, a sleep terror is more physical than mental. During a sleep terror, a child experiences all the physical changes usually associated with fear. His heart is beating rapidly, he is sweating, and his blood pressure rises, and he looks and acts frightened, but when he wakes fully, there is nothing frightening to remember. After a nightmare, however, a child is truly frightened and remembers the dream, but physical changes, such as of heart rate and blood pressure, are relatively mild. When an intense sleep terror begins suddenly, and as may happen in the adolescent, lasts only a minute or two, a child may wake spontaneously to find himself still sweating and his heart still pounding and racing. To explain these feelings to himself, ones typically associated with fear, he may attribute them to a vague threat and say, perhaps, "It was going to get me." By contrast, if a child has had a nightmare, he will be able to give a full dream report with a storyline, characters, and settings. After a sleep terror, although he may feel some of the physical effects associated with fear, they will usually fade rapidly, and he will be able to return to sleep quickly if his parents remain calm. However, even though a child waking from a nightmare will usually be normally responsive, reaching up to be lifted out of the crib as soon as you come into his room, clinging to you when you pick him up, or, if he is old enough, even getting out of bed and running into your room for reassurance, occasionally he may behave at first almost as if he were having a sleep terror. He may appear confused and seem unresponsive to your efforts to comfort him for several minutes. He may point around the room and refer to animals or monsters, but be too upset to describe a coherent dream. This situation happens most often with a very young child who does not fully understand what a dream is, that the monsters are not real, and that the dream is over, and he is safe at home. Still, he will not thrash around as wildly or be as unresponsive as a child actually having a sleep terror. Finally, although both sleep terrors and nightmares may occur frequently or occasionally, events that occur very frequently, several times a week, nightly, or even several times a night, are not likely to be true nightmares, particularly when such frequent events continue for more than 1 or 2 weeks. These events are much more likely to be of a confusional nature. Nightmares or no mares? I had a bad dream. As we saw in Chapter 7, children sometimes report having nightmares when in fact they have not. They call for their parents to come to their room at night, even every single night, saying, "I had a bad dream." These children have simply learned that whenever they say those magic words, they get a big response. If they say, "I want to sleep in your bed," they will be sent back to their rooms. But if they say, "I had a bad dream," they are told, "Come on in." Of course, you should comfort your child when he really has had a scary dream. So, how do you know if the complaint is genuine? Generally, it's not very difficult to tell. Since a child waking from a nightmare is truly scared, he will look and act scared. If your child, like the child described in the section on How Severe Is Your Child's Anxiety in Chapter 7, gathers up his blanket and teddy bear every night, walks calmly to your room, and taps you on the shoulder before saying he had a bad dream, then you can be sure that he didn't. If he can't describe what happened in the dream, that is another sign that it didn't happen. If it had, he would have run to you or clutched you tightly when you answered his call, and he would have a dream story to report. If you are in doubt, err on the side of leniency for a night or two, but remember that scary dreams almost never happen nightly. Whether your child is truly having nightmares should become clear very soon. However, for some children, the words, "I had a bad dream," really mean, "I'm scared." In such cases, it makes little difference whether these children actually had a dream or not. If your child is truly frightened, then you must deal with his fears, as discussed in Chapter 7, whether they arose from wakeful thoughts or from dreams. Chapter 15. Bedwetting. Bedwetting, or nocturnal enuresis, is a very common and frustrating childhood sleep problem that can upset parent and child alike. It occurs in all societies and has been recorded throughout history. Although figures differ somewhat among cultures and among groups within a culture, approximately 15% of all 5-year-olds, 5% of all 10-year-olds, and 1-2% of all adolescents still wet their beds at least once a month. Almost 2/3 of enuretic children are boys. Although the causes of enuresis are only partly understood, several methods of treating the disorder have proven successful. When a child wets the bed, it is not the urination itself, but its aftermath that frustrates and annoys. The child's pajamas and sheets get wet. She wakes up, and her parents might have to get up to change the bedclothes. Even if a child urinated nightly, if somehow nothing got wet in the process, it would not be a problem at all. For that reason, enuresis does not make its appearance as a sleep problem until a child is, or should be, out of diapers. Many families aren't especially perturbed by enuresis, especially if the child is younger than about 7 years old, and the bedwetting is infrequent. If that describes your family, you might choose to wait for it to stop on its own. Just be sure the wetting doesn't upset your child, as discussed in the next section, more than you think. You should be aware, however, that although most children do outgrow the problem eventually, for an individual child, this may not happen any time soon. Only about 15% of enuretic children at each age from 5 to 18 years, will spontaneously outgrow the problem over the next year. Furthermore, the older the child and the more frequent the wetting, the more likely both the child and her parents will be to want to find a solution. The impact of enuresis. Enuresis can affect your relationship with your child, her own self-image, and her interactions with other children. Although she will not remember actually wetting the bed when she wakes, the wet sheets make it clear what happened. She doesn't need you to tell her, as she would after a sleep terror or a sleepwalking episode. Also, since bedwetting generally happens unobserved, again in contrast to sleep terrors and sleepwalking, parents sometimes incorrectly assume that their child was awake and urinated voluntarily, making them angry and resentful rather than sympathetic and concerned. Your reactions are very important. Without your understanding and support, your child will surely suffer. But even if you are fully supportive, even if you really don't mind changing the sheets, your child may still feel ashamed and embarrassed, especially if she is at least 4 or 5 years old and still wearing diapers or pull-ups at night. She may be reluctant to have friends sleep over, to go to their sleepovers, or to attend overnight camp. If her schoolmates find out that she wets the bed, or worse, that she still wears diapers, she may be teased. These emotional effects often prove to be of greater consequence than the bedwetting itself. Although the frequency of bedwetting can usually be reduced greatly using the techniques described in the following discussion, it is not always possible to prevent it entirely. Whether the wetting stops completely or not, if the child's view of herself and her relations with her family can be improved, both she and her parents will be much happier. Antonio was a 6-year-old boy who wet his bed almost every night, although he had been toilet-trained since the age of 3. He did have occasional dry nights, but he had never remained dry for more than a week. His parents were frustrated and angry. Sometimes they punished him, often by denying him special privileges, hoping that that would bring about some control. They made him sleep on a small cot and wear a diaper to bed, saying they would not buy him a regular-sized bed until he stopped wetting. Antonio's parents were caring people, and they loved their son, but they did not understand bedwetting, and the situation was not improving. Besides, they hated imposing the punishments, even though they thought they were necessary, and it was making them feel guilty. Finally, they realized they needed help. When the family came to see me, Antonio was surprised and delighted to hear me explain that it was not his fault, that punishment would not help, and that he should be required neither to wear diapers nor to sleep in a cot. I told him that many children his age still wet the bed. He had thought he must be one of only a few. His father admitted with much embarrassment that he himself had wet the bed as a youngster, something not even his wife had known. Antonio's parents were anxious to correct their mistakes, and I supported their efforts carefully in frequent initial meetings. We embarked on a program of behavior modification, described at length later in this chapter. The results were fairly good. Although Antonio's bedwetting did not cease entirely, it did decrease significantly. And even before that happened, the family had begun functioning much better. Antonio no longer felt ashamed about wetting, and his parents no longer suffered the guilt that punishing him had caused them. Even when parents are not terribly concerned about bedwetting, the child herself can be. Rebecca was an 8-year-old girl who wet the bed several times a week. Her home was happy and stable, and her parents were sympathetic. They accepted her bedwetting without complaint, and although they would have preferred that she be dry, they were not much disturbed by the problem. Rebecca's father had been enuretic until age 10, and he had openly discussed his own history with her. The parents sought my help, not because of their own concerns, but because Rebecca was deeply troubled by the wetting. An intelligent girl who expressed her concerns forthrightly, Rebecca was anxious to begin a program that would help her be dry at night. We started a behavior modification program, which she followed with determination, and to her delight, it was successful. Benjamin, 12, still wet the bed at night, and like most older children and adolescents in his situation, he was very upset by it. In fact, it was affecting his whole life. His self-respect suffered badly. Children in the neighborhood teased him cruelly, and he was becoming withdrawn. He never slept at a friend's house, and never invited a friend to spend the night at his. He wanted to go away to summer camp, but refused to do so until he stopped wetting. Benjamin urgently needed to get the problem under control. Simply knowing that there were other children his age who also wet their beds would not be enough. In his case, behavioral treatments were unsuccessful, but he responded well to medication. His self-esteem was restored, and he was even able at last to go away to camp. What causes enuresis? Several factors may play a role in enuresis: heredity, maturation, small bladder capacity, nighttime awareness of the need to urinate, depth of sleep, medical issues, food sensitivity, emotional factors, and environmental and early childhood influences. For only some of these factors is the relationship certain. Each of these is discussed in the following sections. It may not always be possible to say which are the most important in a given child. Heredity. Overall, heredity is probably the single most significant factor contributing to enuresis. Children whose parents were bedwetters, are much more likely than other children to wet their beds. While only 15% of all children wet their bed, the figure increases to almost half if one parent used to wet the bed, and three-quarters if both parents did. What specific inherited traits are responsible is unknown, but they may include one or more of the other factors described in the discussion that follows, such as a small functional bladder capacity. Maturation. For a child to be continent, that is, to have control over her urination, the part of her nervous system that controls her bladder has to reach a certain degree of maturation. An infant has little awareness of her bladder filling or of the need to urinate. Her bladder empties when necessary by a reflex contraction. At some point between the ages of 1.5 and 2.5, a child begins to recognize when her bladder is full. She may stop playing when she has this feeling, and her facial expression may indicate her awareness that a urination is coming. If she is being toilet-trained at that time, she will be able to get to the bathroom and remove her clothing in time to use the toilet. At this stage, however, she still can't postpone the flow of urine. She will develop that ability over the next year. By age 3 or 4, she can urinate at will, even when her bladder is only partially full, and she can now interrupt her urinary stream after it has started. She can go to the bathroom before leaving the house, even if she does not feel the urge to urinate, and she can catch herself when she realizes she is starting to urinate at the wrong time. At this level of maturation, she is now physically capable of staying dry at night as well. If she continues to wet the bed, other causes are probably responsible. Most children are dry at night before age 4, but of course the actual age varies. A child's bladder grows considerably between the ages of 2 and 4.5, making it easier for her to hold her urine all night. A few babies are even dry at night before their first birthday. By the age of 2.5, about 50% of all children are dry, and by age 3, about 3 out of 4 no longer wet their beds. Although delayed maturation is often blamed for ongoing enuresis, it is unlikely for children of 5 or older to continue to wet for that reason. If your child is toilet-trained in the daytime, then she has the ability to recognize when she is about to urinate and hold it until she is in the bathroom, or until her bladder stops contracting and the urge ceases. If she is dry at night, even occasionally, it suggests that she has the ability to wake up from sleep and do the same thing. Small bladder capacity. Many bedwetters urinate more frequently during the day than non-bedwetters do, and in smaller amounts. Although that seems to imply that their bladders are unusually small, when these children are examined under anesthesia, they are usually found to have bladders of normal size. Because their bladder contractions begin too soon, these children feel the sensation of a full bladder and need to urinate before their bladders are actually full. Furthermore, these early contractions can be very strong. At night, wetting may result. The bladder training techniques described later in this chapter are based on these observations. Nighttime awareness of the need to urinate. A child who wets during sleep may not yet have learned to recognize the sensations from a full bladder, or from a partially full bladder that is already contracting, as a signal important enough to trigger a full waking. You will recall from the discussion of sleep stages in Chapter 2 that a stimulus that is important to you, like your baby's crying, is much more likely to wake you than an unimportant stimulus, like a bird chirping or the wind blowing. Somehow, you have learned to make this distinction even when you are asleep. Your child must learn the same. If she doesn't, then she will not interpret the sensation of impending urination as an important enough signal to cause her to wake up and hold the urine in until Either the urge passes, or she gets to the bathroom. Instead, she will not wake and will wet the bed. Conditioning and behavior modification techniques appear to work by helping your child learn to pay closer attention to these signals. Depth of sleep. Laboratory studies have shown that bedwetting does not take place during dreams. If your child wakes describing a dream about water and her sheets are wet, it does not mean that she wet because of the dream. The wetting episode came first, rather, and the feeling of wetness from the sheets and pajamas then stimulated the dream. Many parents of anuretic children report that their child sleeps more deeply than most other children, and thus is unusually difficult to wake. Those perceptions are probably inaccurate, arising at least in part because whenever the parents try to wake the child to use the bathroom before they go to bed themselves, the child will still be in the period of very deep sleep that predominates in the first few hours of the night. But although the sleep of anuretic children has been shown to be no deeper than that of many other children, it may be that anuretic sleep falls at the deep end of the normal range. Parents of anuretic children rarely, if ever, characterize their children's sleep as light. Because most bedwetting occurs in the first third of the night, usually during or immediately following an arousal from non-REM sleep, it has some similarity to the arousal disorders described in Chapter 13. That might seem to suggest that the urination occurs during the confusion of a partial arousal from deep sleep, even though the partial arousal may be completely normal otherwise. It is true that bedwetting does sometimes accompany sleep terrors and episodes of confused thrashing or sleepwalking. However, in most cases, when a child has both confusional arousals and a tendency to wet the bed, the two behaviors do not occur at the same time of the night, or even on the same nights. Furthermore, episodes of bedwetting also commonly occur during arousals from periods of relatively light non-REM sleep, when sleepwalking and sleep terrors are particularly unlikely to happen. We do know, however, that some bedwetters' bladders contract more during non-REM sleep than during REM. It may be that these contractions sometimes trigger a partial arousal and, at different times, an episode of bedwetting. Medical factors. Most of this chapter discusses what is called functional enuresis, meaning bedwetting that is not related to any medical disorder. Although most bedwetting is functional, you should not assume that your child's wetting has no medical cause. All enuretic children 5 years of age or older should have a thorough physical examination before non-medical treatment begins, both to rule out medical causes and to check for related problems. A urine specimen should also be examined to be sure the child does not have an infection. Urinary tract abnormalities and certain neurological conditions can occasionally cause bedwetting, but in these cases, as well as when there is a urinary tract infection, there will usually be other warning symptoms that occur in the daytime. Dribbling urine, daytime incontinence, frequent strong urges to urinate, or frequent or painful urination, which you or your child will notice, and which your physician will recognize as important. Although urinary tract infections don't generally cause enuresis, they are more common in anuretic children, especially girls, and of course they should be treated. Sometimes children begin to wet the bed after many months of dryness. This condition is called secondary or onset enuresis to distinguish it from primary enuresis, in which the child has never stayed dry at night for long. Medical factors are more likely to be involved in secondary enuresis. But if medical problems can be ruled out, a child with secondary enuresis should respond very well to the same techniques we use to treat primary enuresis. Food sensitivity. In recent years, there has been a great deal of interest in the role of food sensitivity in a number of childhood health problems, bedwetting among them. In a few cases, nighttime wetting reportedly has decreased when certain foods were removed from a child's diet. Although it is conceivable that particular foods irritate the bladder in some children, increasing contractions and decreasing bladder capacity, there is no good evidence to support this hypothesis. In any case, unfortunately, very few children respond at all to changes in their diet. Emotional factors. Bedwetting is somewhat more frequent among children who are emotionally disturbed. However, fortunately, such disturbances are not the cause of most bedwetting, and the vast majority of enuretic children are normally adjusted. Any related emotional problems are more likely the result of the bedwetting than the cause. Environmental influences and early childhood experience. A child's early experience may affect her ability to be dry at night by the usual age. For example, studies have shown that bedwetting is slightly more frequent than average in middle children, children in lower-income families, and children faced early in their lives with stresses, such as chronic illness or their parents' divorce. Stress is particularly disruptive during the third year of life, when a child is usually being toilet trained. If toilet training is handled punitively, a child is also more likely to become a bedwetter. But these differences are small. If your child wets her bed, rest assured that it's not because you haven't been a good enough parent, or because you failed somehow to prevent it. At most, the early family environment can provide only a very small part of the explanation. Approaches to treating enuresis. Throughout history, people have described enuresis and treatments for it. Nowadays, there are humane and caring methods for treating bedwetting, but in the past, enuretic children were subjected to more questionable cures. As early as A.D. 77, Pliny the Elder recommended an elixir made from boiled mice. During the Byzantine era, potions included a fragrant wine made of hare's testicles. And the 19th and 20th centuries brought plenty of new elixirs and potions, most of which have been no more effective than the flowers of the white ox, administered hundreds of years earlier. Special rituals have been tried as well. Enuretic children in the Navajo tribe, for example, were forced to stand naked with legs apart over the burning nest of a phoebe, swallow, or nighthawk, since it was believed that birds do not wet their nests. Some parents, like Antonio's, still make the mistake of trying to stop the bedwetting by means of punishment, ridicule, and shame. Not only is it unhelpful to treat an enuretic child this way, but it may actually prolong or worsen the problem, and the child may suffer emotionally as well. George Orwell, one of the most famous self-admitted enuretics, described the dilemma eloquently. I knew that bedwetting was A, wicked, and B, outside my control. The second fact I was personally aware of, and the first I did not question. It was possible, therefore, to commit a sin without knowing you committed it, without wanting to commit it, and without being able to avoid it. You and your child will be encouraged to know that most enuretic children can learn to wet the bed less often, and many are able to stop doing it entirely. But before you begin your treatment program, you must understand that solving the problem will require patience, persistence, and family cooperation. Results may be very slow in coming, and your child may relapse. The behavioral methods of treatment require a good deal of consistency, and they will work only if both you and your child are willing to accept some temporary inconveniences. Your child can't stop wetting without your full commitment, and you can't make it stop if she isn't interested in participating and doesn't understand what the treatments are doing and why. For these reasons, start by explaining to her and reviewing for yourself just how the urinary system works, what is necessary to avoid wetting, and what the approaches you will be using are actually trying to accomplish. Guidelines and pictures to help explain your child's urinary system to her are shown in Figure 14 in your PDF companion. Some of that information may be new to you, too. Include as much or as little detail as her age and interest require, and modify or adapt the technical language to fit her level of understanding. She should understand that her bladder continuously fills and intermittently empties, that bladder contractions and the automatic reflex opening of the muscle of the internal sphincter lead to a feeling of urgency, the need to go, and that the weak muscle of the external sphincter is then the only thing keeping her dry until she can get to the bathroom or until the contractions stop and the internal sphincter closes again. If her bladder becomes capable of holding more urine before it tries to empty, it will become easier for her to get through the night dry. If her external sphincter gets stronger, she may be able to keep herself dry long enough to wake and use the bathroom. These are the goals of bladder training and start-stop exercises. We treat aneurysis using four main techniques, discussed in detail in the following sections: reinforcement and responsibility training, bladder training, conditioning, and medication. The first three are behavioral approaches and can be undertaken simultaneously or in succession. Many families start with reinforcement and bladder training methods, then try conditioning if the first two are unsuccessful. Medication therapy requires a doctor's supervision and is usually recommended only in certain circumstances. The techniques of lifting and dietary change will also be described. Do not restrict your child's fluid intake during the day. It will not help. It is, however, reasonable to avoid large amounts of liquid after supper and especially near bedtime. Also keep in mind that an initial visit to a doctor is important. Don't begin a program of therapy until you are sure your child does not have a medical problem that needs attention. Before trying any of the behavioral approaches, discuss your plans with the whole family. Everyone will need to feel comfortable about cooperating to solve this problem. If anyone resents the work or teases the bedwetting child, it will be an obstacle. If you have been punishing or criticizing your child for bedwetting, explain to her that you have learned that you were wrong to do so and that you now understand that she wasn't to blame. Let her know that you want to work with her to help her control the problem and to feel better about herself. Don't treat her like a baby. You should probably not leave her in diapers at night if she is past her fourth birthday, definitely not if she is already five and toilet-trained in the daytime. She should sleep in a regular bed. You can use a waterproof pad under the sheet to protect the mattress. Don't restrict her in any way because of the bedwetting. You will need to monitor your own behavior carefully, too. Even the most well-meaning of parents can inadvertently show subtle disapproval when the bedwetting continues. Reinforcement and responsibility training. The first approach to treatment combines two related goals. First, helping your child learn to take on responsibility for dealing with her bedwetting, and second, reinforcing her ability to stay dry. The goal of the responsibility training is to help her learn to be more in control of herself in general. She should feel good about this endeavor, so present it as a privilege and an opportunity, not as a punishment. Once she becomes accustomed to responding promptly and automatically to her own needs, responsibilities, and obligations during the day when she is awake, she will have an easier time doing the same at night when she is asleep. In particular, the sensation of needing to urinate may become significant enough to her to signal her to wake herself enough to prevent wetting, and if necessary, to walk to the bathroom. The reinforcement part of the treatment is intended to increase your child's motivation to react to these nighttime signals and to help her learn to recognize nighttime bladder sensations as important. You should use rewards for this purpose, not punishments. Most people will work harder to earn a reward than to avoid a punishment. If parents and child work together in a spirit of cooperation, the treatment works even better. Begin by discussing with your child how she can assume more general responsibility around the house, perhaps by taking on a job, such as clearing the table, taking out the garbage, or feeding the dog. Above all, she must take on more responsibility concerning the bedwetting itself. She should change her own pajamas, and if she is old enough, usually about 7, she should help change the sheets and do the laundry. But remember, this isn't a punishment. Don't saddle a young child with the entire responsibility for these chores. Instead, give her extra privileges as she takes on the new responsibilities. These changes alone may lead to improvement, but even if they don't, you will be doing your child a service. Her view of herself and you will improve. Next, set up a system for recording and rewarding dry nights. A sticker chart, specially drawn or kept on a calendar, is often successful, at least for children aged up to about 10. Give your child stars for dry nights and award her special prizes after a certain number of stars. You can structure the system to suit your child's age and interests, but you may want to base it on the following example, which has worked well for many children. Choose one color of stars to record dry nights, another color to be used after every 4th dry night, consecutive or not, and a special sticker to mark any 7 consecutive dry nights. Instead of stars, your child may prefer stickers with animals, cartoon characters, or 3D images. Let her help choose them. Agree in advance on a special but inexpensive treat or prize that she will earn for every 2 7-day stickers. Have your child attach the stickers to the chart or calendar and congratulate her when she has earned one. In the meantime, remember never to scold her or make her feel bad in any way after she has wet the bed. Bladder training and start-stop exercises. The next approach is to help your child develop the abilities to hold more urine and to exercise more control over her urination. You can begin bladder training at the same time as responsibility training, or postpone it for a while if you wish. Now would be a good time to, again, review with your child the nature of her urinary system and how it works. See Figure 14 in the included PDF. Once a day, at the same time each day, have your child hold her urine as long as she can, at least to the point of some discomfort. Then, when she urinates, into a bottle, urinal, or pan, measure the volume. Her efforts to beat her previous record will gradually increase her daytime bladder capacity. To pick a starting point, measure the volume each time she urinates at home for the first 2 days, and use the largest single volume of urine over the 2-day period as the initial record to beat. Also, note the amount of time between urinations. If your child urinates more often than once every 3 or 4 hours, have her try to wait 15 to 30 minutes longer each day between urinations until she achieves a 3 to 4 hour minimum. There is no specific volume that will guarantee nighttime continence, but 10 to 12 ounces, or at least 1 ounce per year of age, is a reasonable goal. If that seems too ambitious, then try for at least a 50% improvement over the initial record. At least once a day, also have your child practice starting and stopping the stream of urine several times. She should stop the stream not just momentarily, but long enough to get good control over it. When your child has been dry at night for 2 consecutive weeks, reinforce the success with a program of overlearning. Encourage her to drink more and more fluid during the day, and as much as 2 to 4 glasses just before bed, so that she will keep getting better at controlling her bladder. Conditioning. Conditioning systems have been very successful in treating enuresis. These devices rely on a sensor that fits into the child's underwear at night. When it gets wet, a loud alarm, usually attached to the child's pajamas or wrist, is triggered. Several units are available commercially in the United States and can easily be ordered online. Although older versions of some of these devices posed slight risks of irritation or burns from the electrical current, modern designs have rendered them completely safe. The object of conditioning is to wake your child as soon as she begins to wet the bed, on the theory that she will gradually come to unconsciously associate the sensation she feels just before urinating with the need to wake. To use this method successfully, you will need your child's full cooperation and understanding, so it is unlikely to be much help before she is at least 7, although some younger children are able to profit from it. Both the parents and the child should understand how the mechanism works, but the child should take responsibility for testing it and turning it on when she gets into bed at night. If the alarm rings at night and your child does not wake immediately, it is up to you to wake her as soon as possible. Leave the alarm ringing, however, until she gets up and turns it off herself. She should then go to the bathroom to try to complete her urination there, then help remake the bed if necessary, and reset the alarm. If she wets so early in the night that she simply cannot wake when the alarm sounds, try lifting her. Listen to the section on lifting later in this chapter. Take her to the bathroom before the time when the first alarm of the night usually rings. Later in the night, her sleep will be lighter, so she should wake more easily and will still learn to respond to the alarm. And eventually, if all goes well, to the bladder signals that occur before that. Whether or not she wets later, gradually move the time of lifting toward bedtime, and then stop lifting her altogether. It is crucial that the system be used every night, and that you keep accurate records of the results. The conditioning process can be slow. Be prepared to continue for 4 to 5 months, although most children respond sooner. In general, 25% of children are dry within 2 to 6 weeks, 50% within 3 months, and 90% within 6 months. When conditioning is unsuccessful, it is most often because the family used it inconsistently or incorrectly, or because they stopped too soon. After your child has been dry for 2 weeks, begin an overlearning process as described in the previous section on bladder training. Have her drink extra fluid during the day and 2 to 4 more glasses before bed, and continue to use the alarm until she has stayed dry for an additional 21 consecutive nights. Be aware that when children stop using the alarm the first time, the bedwetting often starts again. If that happens, simply use the alarm again exactly as you did before. Several courses of conditioning therapy are sometimes necessary when the problem is stubborn. Medication. When enuresis is a major problem and behavioral approaches are unsuccessful, medication is occasionally necessary to help bring the problem under control. If you think your child may be a candidate for medication, discuss it with your pediatrician. One medication commonly used is desmopressin. This drug, a synthetic hormone, resembles the naturally produced hormone vasopressin, also known as antidiuretic hormone. Vasopressin is normally secreted at night and helps draw water from the urine back into the bloodstream. The urine that remains is more concentrated, hence there is less of it, making it easier to stay dry through the night. Although there is evidence that some enuretic children produce less than the typically expected amount of vasopressin at night, it is not clear that their hormonal levels are abnormally low. Nevertheless, desmopressin taken at bedtime as a nasal spray or a pill may help to suppress nighttime urination. It is generally not recommended for children under 6 years old. When it does work, it is often useful for special occasions, such as overnight visits, travel, and camp. It can also be used nightly, especially for older children who are distressed by frequent wetting and for whom other approaches haven't worked. Bear in mind that the medication itself usually does not cure the underlying problem, so the bedwetting typically reappears when the desmopressin is stopped. Lifting. You may already be lifting your child, that is, taking her to the bathroom at some point after she has fallen asleep, probably when you are about to go to bed. This precaution sometimes prevents wetting, especially in children who wet only once a night at a regular, predictable hour that is not too late. However, it is unlikely to have any long-term benefits. By rousing the child rather than letting her learn to wake on her own from bladder signals, lifting may actually delay nighttime continence. Besides, the child may already be wet when the parents go in, or she may wet again later in the night. On the other hand, when it does work, at least the child is dry, everyone is less frustrated, and there are fewer sheet and pajama changes to deal with. If you do find lifting useful, I suggest that every 3 months you try going 2 weeks without lifting to check your child's progress and to give her a chance to learn nighttime control or to see if she has already attained it and whether the lifting even needs to be restarted. Dietary changes. Major dietary changes are rarely useful as a means to decrease wetting. They require a lot of work, and improvements are rare. Although advocates of this approach can be persuasive, there is little evidence to support their claims. If you do want to try this method, follow the same diets that are described in books on dietary therapy for hyperactive children. Ask your librarian for help. But remember, any improvement you see may be only coincidental. In any case, don't keep your child on a severely restricted diet indefinitely. Gradually add back the foods you have taken out of her diet. Be sure that a particular food is responsible for increased wetting before you make your child do without it for more than a few weeks. Final words. Enuresis can be difficult to stop entirely, and persistent